Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers, developers, and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, who gives you innovation training your customers will love you for. Get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, this is Chad. My interview is with a very special guest, someone who helps companies around the world, nonprofits, cities, and other groups solve problems and innovate through collaborative games. My thanks to Product Innovation Educators, who sponsors this podcast. That is where I and my colleagues provide online training for product managers and innovators. Find our online training at productinnovationeducators.com. To see the show notes for this episode, please go to theeverydayinnovator.com/037. Enjoy the interview. I'm excited to be discussing innovation and product management with our guest today. He was recommended by the VP of Global Innovation of the RELX Group, Jeff Honius, who is my guest in episode 28. His name is Luke Holman, and he is the founder and CEO of the Innovation Games, which is now known as Contineo. Luke is serious about the smart application of games to optimize decision-making in innovation, product development, and market research, and numerous companies also use his tools. My favorite line from his LinkedIn profile is, Luke's an old-school Silicon Valley entrepreneur. Instead of building a company to flip, he's building a company to change the world. Luke, I appreciate Jeff connecting us, and thank you for discussing innovation with me.
Thank you, Chad. I'm very happy to be here.
So you started your career originally earning a degree in computer science, and then you got into engineering, and you worked for the great company of EDS. I had several colleagues and friends there kind of at the same time. Later purchased by HP. We don't really recognize EDS anymore. But I'm curious about kind of that, just that journey, because a lot of the everyday innovators that are listening do come from that engineering and computer science sort of background, and they either have worked into product management or they're wanting to work into product management and certainly contribute to innovation roles. So what was your journey like moving from those early days to really being someone today who's helping companies with innovation?
My journey even started earlier than that. I didn't start necessarily in engineering. I was actually a figure skater, and I was fairly good. And I was, after high school, I got a 2-year degree in computer science while I was skating. So I was kind of balancing learning a little bit about computer science from a community college in New York State, Erie Community College, and skating. And eventually I got pretty good at skating. And I made a life choice because being an athlete is something you really can only do when you're young. And you can go to school and be a programmer at any age. And so I left college and I went to Detroit, Michigan, where I skated and trained at the Detroit Skating Club. And I did a couple of part-time jobs, and I got lucky when a man named Lewis Mattson, who was the head of the data center in Warren, Michigan, which at the time we called them IPCs, for information processing centers, which were the EDS data centers. And he hired me. And then I worked part-time for EDS doing a variety of very interesting jobs, and then full-time skating. I actually started at EDS as what we called a floor grub. I pulled cable underneath raised floor. And then from there, I literally worked my way from beneath the ground up, and I did networking and other stuff. My skating career ended, and I was very happy with that. And I started to do other cool things at EDS. And starting to make the link into innovation, I was curious, and I had bosses who encouraged and allowed curiosity. So when I would say to a boss, you know, I want to do or learn X, they never said no. They would say, well, go ahead, you know, go learn or do X or go try X. And it wasn't some huge, you know, corporately funded, you know, with glossies and posters innovation program. It was, if you want to work, we'll give you the chance to do good things. And so I think that there was this notion of, it's when I started to really understand this concept of intrinsic motivation, the desire to innovate, the desire to learn, the desire to be, you know, the desire to understand, the desire to be curious, which of course engineers have, you know, very strongly in their training and in their background. And then eventually I did some cool stuff for EDS and I went back to school and got my degree. And then from there I did some other stuff, from working on expert systems at EDS to helping do some transaction processing systems and credit card processing and some other stuff. But I think it's really about the notion of giving people a chance. And I, one of the guys I want to credit in my journey at EDS was a gentleman named Vern Olson, who was the most supportive and really the best manager I've ever had. And so I it was this combination of, look, if you worked hard, you could do really cool stuff and we'll support you.
All started back in the days of being a floor grub.
Yes.
That's a new term to me. And I'm actually pretty sure I have seen you, around my house. It was a typical thing to watch figure skating on the weekends. And I'm pretty sure I saw you performing on TV. And as a floor grub, I remember you being quite tall. I'm sure you still are. And how does that work out as a floor grub being tall too?
Well, it's funny. Some people think I'm tall. I'm 6 foot. And it's funny is my German, Germanic roots in my name, Homan, means tall man. And it's funny because I'm actually the smallest of my family.
You're the runt at 6 foot.
I'm the runt at 6 foot.
There's some giants in there.
Yeah, there are. So it wasn't too bad. I mean, you know, again, when you're young, and you're learning, and you're getting a chance to grow, you know, a little discomfort, just, you don't even notice it. I mean, I couldn't, right. I'm sure I was at times uncomfortable. I don't remember feeling that I was crammed in space because I don't get claustrophobic. What I remember is in the data centers, they have the huge air conditioning units. And what I remember is they would blow the air conditioning into the floor and keep the floor at about 55 to 58 degrees. And you would just get cold. So we would, you know, we would wear those ski mittens and cut off the fingers.
Right. Sure.
So to try and keep our hands warm as we were making cables.
And this is coming from someone who's used to being on ice for hours at a time.
Right.
On top of it.
In cold.
Yeah. I remember that blast of air that comes out of the floor when you pull those tiles in data centers. So the other key thing you said there that I really appreciate is really two of them. Curiosity. So just that natural curiosity to go explore new things. And the supportive infrastructure, right? You had an awesome boss that encouraged you and gave you the freedom to do that too. And those are important characteristics in organizations to let people use their curiosity and explore new things.
Yeah, and it's funny, you know, when we talk about innovations and we talk about innovation management, I think a lot of employees or people who might be product managers or engineers, they're sitting around going, how come my boss hasn't come up to me and given me my innovation? And it's a bizarre concept. It's like, you don't sit down and someone magically gives you innovation, right? You have to have it come from within. So, you know, none of my bosses at EDS came up to me and said, you know, I think you should do this. What they did do, though, is when I had this desire or this curiosity or this passion, they would say, how can we help you? And, you know, in the Silicon Valley, you hear this about the Google culture. Like, you know, at Google, you get X percent of your time to do Y percent of cool things, which is really cool, which is really great. But Google didn't invent this. And I'm not even sure EDS invented it. I think any successful company has a structure whereby the leadership recognizes the intrinsic passions of their people and tries to let them run with it. When I'm teaching product managers, and I know you teach them too, sometimes I tell product managers, you know, you're fooling yourself if you think you're the person coming up with the best ideas, because probably three or four of the best ideas we have in our platform was my engineers coming to me saying, hey, we were thinking and we wanted to try this little thing out and look what we can do. Isn't this cool? And I just go, heck yeah, that's really cool. And that's very innovative. So I just despise this notion of I'm going to sit around and someone's going to walk up to me and give me innovation. I think it's got to be intrinsic, and it's got to be like, I want to go do this.
I completely agree. I think the problem that we've ran into in organizations so much today is there is a bit of a reality that I think we do beat some innovation out of people just as they develop through school, and we kind of take their creativity away from them through the structures we use. But then we put them in these organizations where if they are trying to be innovative, the organizations themselves often resist that, right? And you didn't have that experience.
No. I can't speak to the EDS of today or what it's been, you know, transformed into. But when I was working there, so by the way, I you're right. The organizational leaders could have squashed me. They could have removed and extinguished my desire to be innovative. They could have removed and extinguished my desire to have interesting, cool, and do stuff. But they didn't. And so I think you are correct that organizational leadership can create an environment that is more or less conducive to innovation and its pursuit. But I think it's kind of got to start, and then it's got to be nurtured, and then it's got to be support, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera.
And today, through games, you do a lot of that. So you're helping organizations become more innovative through gameplay. So how did games become that focus of what you do?
Yeah, games, so games were never actually my focus per se. Like, I didn't sit down and say, I want to apply games to innovation. What happened was, after I left EDS, I went to Object Space, which was a consulting firm in Dallas, Texas. And then I went to the Bay Area in 96, and I joined a company called Smart Patents, which became Origin Systems. And we built the world's first data warehouse for patent portfolio management, and quite successful. I started as the director of engineering, and then became the VP of engineering, and became the VP of engineering product management. And so I had that natural history that many people do in the technology field of starting in a technical career and moving into product management. And I think that's really healthy, actually. I think it's really important for whatever given technological product management thing that you're doing to have a foundation in engineering. And then you add in the MBA qualities that you're needing, like finance and marketing and pricing and market research and segmentation and all that kind of stuff. But you want to have a really good grounding in the kind of the core. It's like a human body, right? You want to have core strength. And you asked about games, and I didn't start with games. I just started as a product manager saying, how do I best understand what people are looking for? And I started actually working in the field of low fidelity user research and prototyping. So we used to call it paper and pencil prototyping. Now they call it other stuff. But I would go out with paper and pencil prototypes, and that was better than building source code because it was cheaper and faster. And then I found that the more I made it interactive, the better the result. The less I controlled the process, the better the outcome. And the more I put the pen in my customer's hand rather than in my hand, the more insight I got. And I am kind of the belief that sometimes it's appropriate to ask customers how they would solve their problem. I know the celebrated quote from Steve Jobs is, you know, never ask your customer how to solve the problem because they don't know how. I don't actually agree with that. Many times in technical fields, in the consumer market, I can see that to be true. But many times in technical fields, like if you're working for Emerson and you're building process control software like pumps, or, you know, software that controls pumps, or physical hardware that, you know, controls a pump, and you go to a manager of an oil refinery, they've got a pretty good idea of their problem, and they probably have a pretty good idea of the characteristics of its solution. And listening to those people is really important. So the question becomes, how do you get those insights? And what I started to work on were just, how do I let people express themselves? And I was trained as a cognitive psychologist at school. And then I started to look at, how do people work together? Because I did some organizational behavior work at Michigan. And I started to create these techniques. Well, I didn't know that they were games until later on when I learned about games and game theory. And so what's interesting about this is humans naturally play, we naturally collaborate, and then we naturally create games as a source of those two things. And if you look at games from a game theory perspective, a game has a goal, something you want to achieve. It has a set of rules and resources and constraints and interaction models. It has a mechanism for keeping track of how you're doing, a feedback system. And if it's a game that's played between antagonists, a mechanism of scoring and a mechanism of determining a winner and a loser. And then the curious part about games is that we want to do this. We have natural desires to participate. And I realized that that's where you get these great product insights. So the game theory and the game component kind of came after realizing that all of the stuff that I was doing that was working best were games.
And a few things you said in there, games, the collaboration aspect, the help create collaboration. I like going back to when you were doing prototyping of putting the pin in the consumer's hand, the customer's hand, right? And I envision that these games are helping to get ideas generated from your actual customers at times.
That's right. And, as much as I loved EDS, there were a couple of things that I was taught at EDS that I didn't like when I first learned them. And then by changing it, I got a better result. So an example would be EDS had this process of building software called the software development lifecycle. It was what we would now call a waterfall process, and it didn't seem to work really well. And now we have iterations and stuff, and we call it agile, and that does definitely seem to work better. The other thing is that EDS used to teach us to do this thing called a context diagram. And a context diagram, it was, you can trace that to the work of the Robertsons, who are wonderful, about how to put your system in the context of other actors and systems. But the way that EDS did it was they would have the analysts, people like me or people who are interviewing customers, we'd go out and we would interview a lot of people and we would build a context diagram. And then we would take the context diagram that we had digested and built back to new customers to see how we did, right? Mm-hmm. And that sounds really good. But what happened was it's what I call the high school proof syndrome. And you remember in high school, you're sitting in the room and you're listening to your instructor describe the geometric proof, and you go, because it's making sense. And you agree with every step of the way, but then when you try and do it, it doesn't make sense. And so the right. equivalent was we would take these context diagrams to customers, and they would go, yes, I understand. Yes, I understand. They were understanding our elaboration, but they weren't agreeing that it matched their environment. And so what I started to do, it makes mm-hmm. sense now. But what I started to do, which was kind of this radical thing, was I would start with a context diagram with like two things. And then I would say to the customer, could you finish it? Could you complete it? And they would, you were taught it, by the Robertsons, you have to build really beautiful, clean context diagrams. And the customers who would draw the context diagrams that I worked with would draw these messy, not easily understood, complex, things, but it was their world. It was their reality, because their world was messy and it was complex and it wasn't clean. And that's what became the innovation game Spiderweb, for example, where I'm trying to say, put the pen in the hand of your customers, let them draw the picture, and you will get far more insights. And oh, by the way, add these elements and you end up with a game, and it's a lot more fun.
So I think we need a concrete example here to help bring some clarity to this. So what is one of your favorite innovation games that you've seen really help move groups forward on a new idea?
Chad, I have four kids. That's like asking me which of my kids is my favorite kid. I love them. I love them all. But
I'm sure they all have their place, but we're going to have to pick one to talk about.
That's right. So I'm going to, instead of saying favorite, I'm going to say which of my games feels like an underdog, because some people may not play them as much. And so my out of my four kids, my youngest is also the smallest. So Danella often gets a little extra love for no other reason than she's the pipsqueak of the family.
Right.
So one of the games that I don't think gets used enough, especially internally, is a game called Buy a Feature. And the way this game works is any successful company has more ideas, more features, and more projects in their project portfolio than they can afford.
Absolutely. We all are resource constrained, and we all have this issue of, you know, it's kind of the magpie syndrome, right? We see all these shiny objects around that we want to pursue, and there's not enough resources to do all of them.
That's right. And so so what Buy a Feature does is it says, well, let's take about 20 of them so we can manage complexity, and we take all the prices of those projects. And I'm going to use some easy numbers for the listeners. So let's say that you had 20 projects in your project portfolio. And magically, even though they had different prices, they all added up to $20 million.
Okay.
And let's say that your portfolio budget was only $8 million. Well, what we do with the Buy a Feature game is we say, take eight people in your organization and give them each $1 million to spend. And you're like, well, wait a minute. The total budget is $8 million. Shouldn't they each get eight? Well, no, because they're going to work together. So instead of a competitive market like an eBay, it's a collaborative market. And so, Chad, let's say that you and I are looking at different projects and there's one in there for $1.8 million and you really want it. And so you plunk down your entire million on it. Well, if you really think it's the right thing to do for the company, you're going to start investing in explaining its virtues to the other players. And if you convince me, I'll put my $800,000 on it, and we just bought the project or bought the feature. And it's an amazingly powerful way to get insights from customers. But the organizations that I think would benefit the most are organizations who have significant service people, because the service people are never really asked for their opinion about what would truly help the product be successful.
It's a good way to get the stakeholders on the same page, supporting the projects that are most important.
That's right. Because what you get is an outcome. So I have a phrase that's well known: surveys suck, because surveys will tell you what the answer is, but they won't give you the conversation and a deeper meaning behind it. So when you look at Buy a Feature, at the end of the game, you're going to get the same result that you would get as a survey, right? You'll get the prioritized list, but you get something that's much more important than just the prioritized list.
Right.
You get the arguments. So when you start convincing me about the importance of this project, and there's another player in the game, and her name is Ming, and Ming is also trying to convince me to join you, if your arguments are better, then I'm going to gravitate towards what you said because you made the more convincing argument. And the reason why I brought up Buy a Feature is the underdog is because this also ties into my philanthropic work. I have a sister organization that we call Every Voice Engaged Foundation, and that's a 501c3 nonprofit. And Every Voice Engaged Foundation uses this same technique with citizens to help them prioritize budgets in cities through a process called participatory budgeting. And participatory budgeting is Buy a Feature just applied to a city budget as opposed to a set of projects in a project portfolio or a set of features in a list of features for customers.
Yeah, and those are some pretty challenging problems to address. And if we can help some of our cities and states more effectively manage their budgets through this, you're doing some really good work there.
Yeah, and it's really exciting because last year, we were working with hundreds of residents, both in person and online, with San Jose, California. And one of the there's videos that people can watch, and this from Every Voice Engaged. But in the video, you know, there's a set of things that aren't games that people think are games. So puzzles and simulations are not considered games because they have a predetermined outcome. And a game has an uncertain outcome that is determined through the interaction of its participants. So what happens, there's some tools out there, Chad, like the that let you simulate the budget of the federal government, but you play them in a, or you don't play them, but you use them in a solitary way. And what you find is that whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, the only way to get a budget balanced is to take whatever your point of view is and make it extreme. So if you're a Republican, you'll cut out all the social programs. If you're a Democrat, you'll cut out all the military, right? Which, and I'm using purposefully extreme arguments here. But what happens is these things harden political will, and they make it harder for our country to come together.
Right. They destroy collaboration. And you're trying to use these games to create collaboration.
That's right. And we've actually got evidence from our work in San Jose that the use of these tools soften political will and help create collaboration. And then the question becomes, well, does that translate into business? And the answer is yes. We've got evidence that when a business takes their project portfolio from different business units and takes players from business units and mixes them up. So you might be playing a game where there's 20 projects of which, you know, 10 are from one business unit, 6 are from another, and 4 are from another, and you mix up the participants. You can see that the behavior of the participants is that they rise above their business unit and they focus on what's right for the company. And we see that consistently when given the chance to focus on what's right for the company, people do it.
That's a pretty powerful outcome, because managing those portfolios is always challenging for companies. And again, it's the issue of too many projects, not enough resources, and where do we best invest that money? And you end up sometimes with, you know, the loudest voice kind of ruling the outcome, right?
Which is, yeah, sometimes that's called the HIPPO, the highest paid person's opinion.
Right.
And, you know, one example of this would be a project we did for a company called BWin Party. Now, BWin Party isn't terribly well known in America, but it's very well known in Europe. It's a gambling company that does online poker, like Poker Stars, and things like that. So it's well known in Europe, very mm-hmm. big company, over $1 billion in revenue. And we were doing a project with them to prioritize their project portfolio. And the way we did it was we took the leadership of the company and we did buy a feature. We did two games because we want to have humans collaborate in groups of 3 to 8. So they had about 13 people in their executive leadership team. And so we put them in two groups. And then we went down and we did the same thing with their extended leadership team, their directors and senior directors. And we started to compare and contrast the results. First thing is, on the most important strategic items, there was perfect alignment between the leaders and their directors. And that was really good because the leaders were like, these are the most important things, and we see really good alignment. But then we started to see within the leadership team, there was one project that the leaders funded that none of the extended team funded. And there was one project that the leaders didn't fund that all 4 of the extended teams funded.
And you say, now, isn't that interesting?
Right. We said, now, isn't that interesting? So we cracked open the chat logs and we started to understand why the leaders didn't fund it and why the extended leaders didn't. We analyzed that and came back and said to the leaders, here's why you said you didn't want to fund it. Here's the counter argument from your extended leaders, and look at what they introduced into the conversation. Did you consider this? And they went, oh my, no, we didn't. We think our extended leaders found something that we didn't consider and we didn't know. We're going to change. And I think that that's a pretty amazing example of what it means to introduce collaborative technology across a company where people are willing to listen to each other, as opposed to a normal survey or not involving those people would have just had the leaders say, you know, we're going to do the project we want to do. But in this case, they clearly changed because of the feedback from the larger organization.
Yeah, that collaboration that took place. And, you know, organizations come down to the projects that they do. And when it comes to creating new products, those are just projects. And the ones that we select can really make the difference in the direction the organization goes and the overall success of the organization.
Yes.
So it seems like getting that collaboration is really valuable.
That's a great quote that you just said, right? Because we are. I mean, you know, what are we doing? And well, these are our projects. Our, you know, a product is a collection of projects that get stacked. If you're successful, you keep stacking them. And if you're unsuccessful, you end of life it.
We have the operations things that are always going on. It's those projects that make the difference of the future of the company.
Absolutely.
So I appreciate sharing the example of the B1 party gambling company. And I'm curious, so there's a list of games here that you have put together and your organization has put together. And I don't know if you have like a resource for the listeners available to just maybe put one of these games in practice with a team that they have somehow to, you know, get their hands around this and actually try it out.
Yeah. So going back to the definition, kind of like the theoretical definition of the game, a game has a goal. Mm-hmm. And so one of the important things that we want people to know is that there's not a single game that will solve their problems, because I remember when I was a young kid and I was starting to understand the humor of the comics in the paper. And there's a comic called Hagger the Horrible. And Hagger leans over to his son in the first panel and he says, "Son, I'm about to tell you one of life's most important lessons." And you can see in the middle panel, his son perks up and leans back. And in the final panel, Hagger says to his son, "One size does not fit all." And so I, you know, it's kind of this quirky thing. When I was a kid, I remember that. And so when people say, you know, "Tell me about the game I should play," and the answer is, well, I don't know, what's your goal? And I think that goes back into the theoretical definition of a game. A game has a goal. Now, the meta goal of entertaining games is entertain me. And some people get entertained by playing Scrabble, and some people get entertained by playing chess, and some people get entertained by playing Settlers of Catan. The meta goal of a serious game is solve a business problem. So then it boils down into, well, what's your business problem? And mm-hmm. The way that I find it most effective in business, not purely, but most of the time, the best way to get started is to identify a simple statement that goes like this: I want to, verb, noun, person. I want to prioritize product features with customers. And if you give me that, we can give you a game. And our online platform at innovationgames.com actually has a verb noun selector at the top where you, when you log in, it actually gives you a chance to say, "I want to," and then you pull down and there's a set of verbs that we have found common in business, you know, prioritize, discover, create, allocate. And then the common verbs that we see in business, you know, features, Or I want to prioritize for software teams technical debt. For sales teams, I want to prioritize sales resources or sales deals. And so I think that the real trick is, and the trick is to be simple, like not to be all fancy. And of course, we all know that being simple is hard. But if you can boil it down to, I want to, verb, noun, person, you can pull out the right game for your need.
Okay. And I don't want this to turn into a commercial, but I am curious about the application of this. And you mentioned, because I know you do gaming workshops, but you just mentioned an online tool to help you, you know, select the game. And then it also sounded like an online environment for the games.
Yeah. So we do, I started, and my book Innovation Games, it actually started with only in-person games. And I didn't really have this grand vision of building a software company when I started. And it was SAP that kind of grabbed me by the hand and dragged me forward and said, "You really got to put this stuff online." And we started building a software platform. So one of the things that I think is really important, and I think a lot of people are missing in the world, is, you know, we've got this rush to go online, but in reality, some of the most successful tools are things that help us meet up in person, like Meetup or Evite or even Facebook, or you know, coordinating an in-person meeting. So the reality of human collaboration is that we crave what I call multidimensional collaboration. We want to collaborate in person. We want to collaborate like you and I are online right now using Skype. Mm-hmm. We want to collaborate in small teams. We want to collaborate synchronously and asynchronously. And so we tend to crave complexity in our collaboration because it's such a natural part of our human existence.
That's a great point. And having an online environment to facilitate that is really easy for, you know, just where we are today.
Right. And so to your point, I agree. I don't necessarily want this to turn this into a commercial either, because I don't think that the online platform solves all of the problems. I mean, if you're working with a group of customers and a customer advisory board, I wouldn't recommend that you go online. I would recommend that you find a way to work with them directly in person. I think the modality is the second, by far the second goal. I think the more important thing is what do you want to accomplish? What are you going to do?
And yeah, what's that problem that you have?
Right.
And what's the goal that you want to put together to get there?
Right.
Okay. Very good. Well, I know we got to talk through a little bit about your background and how you came to Innovation Games and some a specific game and the application. And as listeners know, when we kind of get to the end of the interview here, I always ask for an innovation or success quote. And I wanted to ask you for the one that you brought, and if you'll share that with us.
Yes. Listeners, I brought a long one, and Chad told me it was long, but it's really from my heart. And I hope that you guys who are listening, I want you to know that this one's from my heart, and I wish I would have been the person to write it, but I wasn't. But it's really important. It's from Teddy Roosevelt, and the quote goes like this: "It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbled or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs and comes short again and again, who knows the great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who, at the best, knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who, at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who know neither victory nor defeat."
I do enjoy a lot of the work that Teddy Roosevelt did, and this quote and the courage that comes through in this quote. And where did you come across this one? How did you find it?
Well, I found it when I was looking for something to help me feel inspired about the work that I do. And I had just written the draft of my first book, Journey of the Software Professional, where I look at cognitive psychology and organizational behavior in organizations of software developers. And I submitted it to Prentice Hall. And my editor came back, the guy who became my editor, but he came back and he said, "I've submitted your book to three reviewers, and I've never had this response. One loved it, one hated it, and one said he didn't understand it. And yeah. I don't know what we should do." And I said, "Well, Paul," his name was Paul Becker. I said, "Paul, I don't know what you're going to do. I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to write the best book I can write. And if it succeeds, great. And if it fails, that's okay too." And then I started. Then the book designer, the person that helps you design your book, said, "You know, a book like this should have a quote in the front." And I wanted to find a quote that kind of captured that feeling. Hmm. And this quote, you know, captured that feeling. And it became something that became very important to me.
Absolutely. Being in the arena, striving, and regardless of the outcome, you did all you could.
And the other part of this that I think is really relevant to product management and product management, product management is and I'm going to sound a little dismissive right now. There are a lot of tech companies that I think are explicitly built to flip. And you mentioned that in my bio, right? Mm-hmm. Where a company will do just enough work to get acquired. And the founders make a lot of money. And for them, there is no passion. It's purely an economic endeavor. And they don't care other than they want to make more money than they put in. And it's just a machine of ideas, if you will. And they don't, for them, it's a job. And that's why I say I'm an old school entrepreneur, because we're going to try and change the world and make the world a better place through collaborative play and collaborative games. If we succeed, great. But we're not doing it for the money. We're doing it for the intrinsic motivation of trying to do something better. And if we fail, if we were to some reason fail, we would know that we would not be among the cold and timid souls, or the cold and soulless souls who are just trying to flip a company, right? We wanted to do something great.
Yeah, something that makes a difference.
And that's what I think most product managers do. I think most really good product managers are driven from this passion within.
Absolutely. The great product managers at a minimum want to delight the customer, solve real problems and delight the customer.
Yeah, and maybe that's one thing that we'd want to leave for the listeners, right? If older product managers, if you're becoming where product management is a job of moving requirements to the engineers, then leave. Go find what ignites your passion again, because you had it one day when you became a product manager. And for younger product managers, especially the engineers, if you think that the reason you should become a product manager is because you'll finally be in control of the requirements and you can tell the people to build what you want, then keep looking, because that you're not the right product manager for success.
Absolutely. I had flashback to the movie Office Space and the manager, I can't think of his name right now, right? When he's being interviewed by the business consultants and says, "What do you do?" "I carry the requirements from the customers to the engineers." "Well, do you write them?" "No." And there's other, "All I do is I carry them." There is more to this work than just carrying the requirements.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very good. Hey, I really appreciate the time to talk with you. Just to wrap up, what do you want to leave listeners with? And certainly, how can they learn more about the innovation games and stay up with your work?
Well, I guess the last thing I'd like the listeners to know is games are the ideal collaboration tool. And we really can make the world a better place through collaborative play. And to find me, I'm pretty easy to find. You can get me at contenio.co, contenio.co, or innovationgames.com, or just Google me and find me. I'm not a hard person to find.
Very good. And if I could get you out to Denver sometime to do a workshop and teach some other people about innovation games, you'd be up for that?
I would absolutely be up for it. And I would love the listeners to, come and join us.
That would be great fun. Thanks so much for talking today.
Thanks.
My thanks to all the everyday innovators who listen to and share this podcast. If you listen on iTunes, please leave a 5-star rating. It only takes a few seconds, or write a review. That's even better. That will make it easier for other product managers and innovators to find this podcast. Also, the show notes and details of the discussion are at theeverydayinnovator.com/037. Thanks to productinnovationeducators.com, your one source for online product management and innovation training.
Thank you for listening to Product Innovation Training Your Customers Will Love You For. To learn more, please check out the blog at theeverydayinnovator.com. Keep innovating.